This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, April 24, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear what some Congress members have to say about soaring gas prices. We'll hear about Aramark janitors organizing for better working conditions in Houston. And we'll go to Zimbabwe, where voters are still awaiting the results of their pick for president. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in Gaza has warned of a collapse of various humanitarian services if the lack of fuel persists. Rami Al-Magari has more.
Israel continues the closure of the Gaza Strip's crossings. The 1.5 million residents continue to suffer lack of fuel and vital items for their daily living. Almost 3 weeks ago, Israel sealed off the main fuel terminal in eastern Gaza in the wake of a cross-border attack on the terminal. John Geng is the operations director of UNRWA in Gaza.
We're also trying to cope with the collapse in education standards. There's a wholly inadequate supply of food and other vital materials. Those few items that are available, the prices are spiraling out of control. Healthcare, water and sanitation services, all on the brink of disaster.
In January, the Israeli government decided to further minimize shipments of fuel into the Hamas-ruled coastal enclave in what Israel says is a bid to stop homemade rocket fire into nearby Israeli towns. Since June of last year, the Islamist Hamas party has been in full sway of the Gaza Strip, following factional infighting with the Fatah party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who is committed to peace with Israel. Hamas has shown peace talks with Israel until Israel holds actions on the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
The UK, England and Wales are facing their first national teachers' strike in 21 years. Natalia Viana has the story.
One-third of all schools in England and Wales were disrupted in the one-day strike. 8,000 schools were partially closed, affecting more than 2.5 million students. Teachers staged more than 50 rallies around the country to demand a 4.1% pay raise. They refused an offer from the government of a 2.45% raise based on the recommendation of an independent review body. According to Schools Minister Jim Knight, the average salary in England and Wales is about $67,000 per year. In London, more than 6,000 teachers and civil servants marched in Westminster. Other rallies occurred in places like Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds, Sheffield and Cardiff. Prime Minister Gordon Brown claimed the strike was called by a minority of teachers and said it was unfortunate and regrettable. All major political parties condemned the strike. Even so, the National Union of Teachers has said it cannot rule out further strikes in the coming months. From London, I am Natalia Viana for Free Speech Radio News.
The National Park Service will contribute about half of a $3.3 million payment to the Church Universal and Triumphant Incorporated to permit a limited number of bison to safely migrate. Jim Kent reports.
The Church Universal and Triumphant owns land adjacent to Yellowstone National Park that's used to graze cattle. Bison from the park's herd frequently migrate across church property during winter months. The agreement between the church, the NPS, and the state of Montana calls for removal of cattle from church property for 30 years. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks spokesperson Mel Frost explains.
It would allow 25 bison to pass through the property. We could potentially increase the number of bison up to 100 in future years.
Lakota elder Rosalie Little Thunder walked from Rapid City to Yellowstone in 1999 to protest the slaughter of the park's bison. Little Thunder says she's not impressed by the numbers or the agreement.
It feels like a publicity thing. Oh yeah, we've reached this very important agreement, and it doesn't mean a whole lot to me.
Little Thunder is at the United Nations Forum on Indigenous Issues in New York City this week. She plans to ask the UN to intercede in the Yellowstone bison kill issue. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent.
The United States has less than 5% of the world's population, but it has almost a quarter of the world's prisoners. According to the International Center for Prison Studies at King's College London, Americans are locked up for crimes, from writing bad checks to using drugs, that would rarely produce prison sentences in other countries, and they are kept incarcerated far longer than prisoners in other nations. The United States comes in first, too, in order of incarceration rates. It has 751 people in prison or jail for every 100,000 in population. The only other major industrialized nation that even comes close is Russia, with 627 prisoners for every 100,000 people. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
In light of soaring gas prices, some Congress members are sending a strong message to oil-producing nations. If we don't get more oil from you, you won't get more arms deals from us. FSRN's Karen Miller has more from D.C.
Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, says in the current gasoline crunch, Americans are paying, oil-producing nations are reaping the benefits, and the Bush administration is allowing it to happen.
The Saudis and big oil companies are in cahoots, and this administration has coddled them both for far too long. The bottom line is that the whole Bush tax cut for middle-class families this year will line the pockets of OPEC. The stimulus check families receive in the mail next month will probably go to pay eye-popping gas and grocery bills this summer alone.
Schumer, along with several other senators, are sending a letter to President Bush that says the U.S. needs to use its leverage with OPEC to produce more oil or risk Congress holding up arms deals with these countries. Currently, there are $14 billion worth of arms deals on the table. Senator Schumer.
We want to put the administration on notice that if they fail to deal aggressively with OPEC countries that are not producing at their full capacity, we will seriously consider blocking this and other arms deals.
Recently, several OPEC countries have said they will not increase oil production before next fall. Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, says this does not give the U.S. a fair deal or a fair shake.
Now, our point to the Saudis and the OPEC countries is this. If we have strategic partnerships, partnership works both ways. And you have things you want from us, we have things we want and expect from you.
If the senators do not get any response from the administration or OPEC, their next step will be to introduce a resolution to block any arms deals in Congress. They say this resolution could be to the floor by next month. But Rachel Stoll, senior analyst for the Center for Defense Information, says this is where the plan might hit a snag.
It's a nice sentiment, but in reality, it's not very likely. To have a resolution of disapproval on an arms sale is incredibly difficult because it has to be veto-proof, which means not only do you have to have enough senators to actually have the bill pass Congress the first time, you then have to have it so that if the president vetoes it, you have enough votes to overturn it.
Stoll says most arms deals are government-to-government transactions, and the Bush administration would not negotiate a deal that they could not make happen. She also says there are other reasons that the U.S. would want to keep these deals up and running.
The Bush administration definitely uses arms sales, as all administrations do, as a tool of its foreign policy. So while that provides an opportunity to use arms sales as leverage, the reality is to an area like the Middle East, arms sales are incredibly important in establishing and reinforcing our military relationships with countries.
In addition to pressuring OPEC to increase oil production, other members of Congress are calling on the Bush administration to open up U.S. petroleum reserves to combat growing gasoline prices. Today, the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming held a hearing. Chairman of the committee, Edward Markey of Massachusetts.
The Bush administration is willing to deploy our National Guard reserves in Iraq, but it refuses to deploy our oil reserves to protect consumers and our economy.
The committee said opening the reserves would bring oil prices down and stop speculation in the oil markets, but they did say, however, that it would only be a short-term solution. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
The top leader of pro-Taliban militants in Pakistan has directed his comrades to immediately cease their activities. Beitullah Masood, the head of the country's umbrella militant group Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, issued the orders through pamphlets found in tribal areas. The letter warns that these directives should be complied with and those violating them will be publicly punished. The statement comes a day after Pakistan's new government drafted a peace agreement with the militants in Pakistan's restive tribal district. Masood, who is believed to have close links with al-Qaeda, is blamed for ordering the assassination of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Under the proposed peace deal, pro-Taliban militants would put an end to attacks on security forces, while government troops would be gradually withdrawn from the region. The plan requires local tribesmen, represented by their elders, to expel all foreign militants within 1 month and pledge not to give them shelter in the future. Taliban spokesman Maulvi Omar confirms that Commander Beitullah Masood has issued the letter.
Beitullah Masood is serious in peace talks, and if the government also reciprocated, then the peace truce would be signed soon.
Pakistan's government has welcomed Masood's announcement shunning terror activities. In more news from Pakistan, threats from the local Taliban have left parents wary about sending their daughters to school in Dara Adam Khel, a semi-autonomous tribal area near Peshawar. FSRN correspondent Ramanola has more.
The Taliban consider girls' schools as a source of promoting westernization against the tenets of their version of Islam. The Taliban argue girls' education creates obscenity in the society. Pakistan's primary school enrollment rate for girls is already the lowest in South Asia, standing at 45%. In the semi-autonomous Dera Adam Khel region, the Taliban have bombed many girls' schools. Parents like Rizwanullah are now afraid to send their daughters to schools.
I am very concerned about my daughter's education when she goes to school. For the entire day, I am worried about her, that whether she will come home or not. Taliban has time and again threatened her to stop education. Taliban have burned many girls' schools and they have threatened us to stop your children, your daughter's education. So in these circumstances, I have made my mind to migrate from Dera Adam Khel to Peshawar for the sake of her security and her education.
Many girls in Dera Adam Khel say their parents are too afraid to send them to school. Javeria is one of many students who are trying to keep up with their studies at home, but it is hard.
When we come to school, we face many problems, but the major problem is security. Our parents are afraid to send us to school. The fear of something bad happening is always there in our mind. There are many problems, especially security. Insecurity also affects our concentration badly.
Nasira Mohib, a teacher at a girls' school in Dera Adam Khel, says they are receiving constant threats from the militants. She also blames government for not providing proper security to schools.
Though I am teaching here, the fact is I am really fighting against the Taliban, the real rulers here. You know that the Taliban are strictly against women working outside of their homes. While leaving for school this morning, I often wonder whether I will return home alive to see my children. The Taliban have distributed pamphlets here threatening women, insisting they cover their bodies according to Islam and Sharia.
According to Education Directorate for the region, there are total 149 schools in the region. Due to the Taliban's attacks on girls' schools, they are all closed now. Qari Ghulamullah, a religious scholar, says Islam permits women education, but only under certain conditions.
Islam permits education for women in Padah. Padah is compulsory in Islam. If this condition is violated, then Islam doesn't permit it. Education is also necessary, and Islam allows both men and women to be educated. But Padah is also vital.
Fazal Manan, director of schools at Provincial Education Department, says officially no school is closed in Dera Adam Khel.
Of course, we have informed the authorities, the Secretary for Law and Order, and a coordination officer about their bomb blast, which has occurred in 8 schools during the night. Though the incidents caused no casualties, the school buildings were badly damaged. We have taken up the issues with the political administration. The administration provides security forces to the schools for some time, but the fear is still there. In such situations, we cannot compel anybody from coming to schools. Education is not the first priority in this case. Survival is the priority. If someone survives, only he or she will be able to get an education.
Educating girls has been a controversial issue in the conservative Pashtun society for a long time. But the recent surge of Talibanization across Northwest Frontier Province and Pakistan's tribal areas has further jeopardized the prospects of girls' education in the region. For Free Speech Radio News in Peshawar, this is Rahmanullah.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Coming up next, is Zimbabwe's ruling party planning a major crackdown against the opposition? I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned. Off the coast of southern Africa is a Chinese ship loaded with mortars, rocket-propelled grenades, and a reported 3 million rounds of ammunition. The arms shipment was intended for delivery to Zimbabwe, where the ruling ZANU-PF party is delaying presidential election results. The party is widely speculated to have lost. Delivery via South Africa was blocked by dock workers' refusal to unload the weapons. South Africa's government said it had no reason to prevent transshipment, but a legal challenge by activists ended with the judge ordering the weapons seized and the ship hastily left port. Zimbabwe's opposition fears the weapons are part of the government's plan for a major crackdown, which will prevent them from claiming victory in last month's elections. FSRN's Mpumi Magwaza reports from Durban, South Africa.
Between the presidential disputes, President Robert Mugabe reminded his followers that Zimbabwe will never be ruled by white minority ever again.
Whereas yesterday they relied on brute force to subjugate our people and plunder our resources, today they have perfected their tactics to more subtle forms. Zimbabwe will never be a colony again.
These are the words of President Mugabe at the 28th anniversary of Zimbabwe's independence in Harare Stadium. Reports by government-owned paper The Herald has put forward suggestions that both parties should take steps in forming national unity government. Mugabe remains a charismatic but increasingly isolated figure. After 28 uninterrupted years in power, his ZANU-PF party did poorly in elections at the end of March. The government has refused to release results, instead ordering recounts in its 23 constituencies. Zimbabwe Electoral Commission reported that the recount in 2 of 23 constituencies has confirmed the initial results. The Movement for Democratic Change questioned the capacity of regional leaders to mediate the conflict among competing parties after a meeting held in Lusaka failed to compel Mugabe to release election results. At that meeting, South African President Thabo Mbeki outraged Zimbabwean opposition when he denied that their country is in crisis. At a protest outside the International Parliamentarians Union meeting in Cape Town, South Africa, Zimbabwean protesters expressed their disappointment. Desperate, a Zimbabwean refugee who didn't give his surname demanded more pressure to be applied on the current ruling party.
The message to these people is they've been saying there's no crisis in Zimbabwe. All this being spearheaded by Mbeki. But we're trying to show them that, we're trying to tell them and give the message to them and tell them that there is crisis in Zimbabwe. Maybe they're waiting for bloodshed, which is already happening in Zimbabwe, and then I don't know which crisis they're actually waiting to get. Well, we need so much pressure to be put on Gabe to actually accept that he lost to Tsvangirai, and Tsvangirai is going to take over and start rebuilding the country.
Opposition figures charge that the delay in releasing election results is to allow the ruling party time to regroup for a rerun election, this time accompanied by violence. Ordinary Zimbabweans had been denied the right to protest or to organize themselves to demand that the results be released. People protesting against the recount have been arrested. John Ndavume, a Zimbabwean student in Durban, witnessed incidents of intimidation in his hometown, Bulawayo.
I came here. I was walking in town, and it was just a normal Saturday morning. And as we were walking in town, a couple of women were having a march. They called Women of Zimbabwe Arise. So as they were demonstrating and having their march, they were just about to distribute their pamphlets, and they actually threw them onto the road. And then as people were about to pick them up, police came and started beating people up. People just began to scatter right in town in the CBD.
Even though Zimbabwe is facing political paralysis and fear of more violence, John is hopeful.
It's important that we don't have to be looking back as the past regime, should I say, saying that we need to look back in order to look forward. The most important thing is to say, let's look forward and chart the way forward as a united people.
The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission has confirmed that the final results will be out by end of this week. While Zimbabweans wait, the leader of the opposition party has fled the country to find refuge in Ghana. For FSRN, this is Mbumi Magwaza in Durban. In the media, Cape Town's Peter Van Aysden also contributed to this report.
Food service workers in Houston earn as little as $6.30 an hour for their work. Now they're demanding improved wages and working conditions. FSRN's Rachel Clark reports from Houston, Texas.
Hola, gente.
It was nearly 2 years ago that mostly immigrant women janitors walked off the job. The historic month-long strike resulted in higher wages, paid vacations, and health care for them and their families. Last November, they were out in force once again.
My name is Juan Alberto. I am a janitor here in Houston. Like my sister Maria, I am proud to be here to start this new fight.
This new fight is in solidarity with Aramark workers. Aramark is one of the nation's largest food service providers. School districts, sports stadiums, and arenas across the country are among its clients. Despite serving millions with a smiling face, working for this corporate giant doesn't leave much to be happy about. Just ask Vernita Murdoch.
When I started working at Aramark, I really liked setting up conventions and exhibits and interacting with public people. But after I spoke up about the way my supervisor was sexually harassing me, Aramark punished me and changed my job. This was not right. I shouldn't be punished because of the supervisor harassing. I did nothing wrong. It's very hard to live on $6.30 an hour and Aramark pays me.
Vernita is one of the first workers to step forward and demand more from Aramark. She is always sure to include how the janitor's struggle inspires her when she recounts her experiences before a crowd.
We want to be on the path like the janitors in office building. We want to be on a path better wages. We want to work in places where we are respected. Because isn't there a path for a good Houston?
Being on the front lines hasn't been without its price, though.
When I spoke out about forming the union, I was terminated. When I spoke to a council meeting, and I was at Hilton for the council meeting, and I was suspended at first, and then I was terminated.
To date, Houston Aramark has fired 10 employees for union organizing. In response, the workers have filed a series of complaints against the firm for unfair labor practices. With Vernita still front and center, these former Aramark employees even took their case before Houston City Council.
We are being punished just for standing up for our family and our future. You can help all Aramark workers make a better life for their families. All we want is the same process that our officer janitors had when they formed their union. We want a fair way to form our union without being threatened.
Last week, Houston Aramark workers kicked off a nationwide tour to draw attention to this new battle. The solidarity they have with janitors has drawn other Latino community activists like Maria Jimenez to their cause.
As a Houstonian, I was never so proud as the day I watched janitors ratify their very first citywide union contract. Just as we stood with Houston janitors, we are ready to stand beside Aramark workers. Estamos listos para la lucha.
And although she struggles at times with English, Juana Alberto, drawing from her own personal experience, has a very clear message for Vernita and the other Aramark workers.
You probably have anger. You are probably mad. Don't be afraid. On behalf of the union janitors in office building, we send a message of support and unity. To all the Aramark workers here today, I say to you, don't give up!
Reporting from Houston, Texas, I'm Rachel Clark, Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tina Gysi. Today's headlines editor is Nell Abram. She's sitting in for Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Oscar Hernandez. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.